It is officially Pesach season. Anyone who's Jewish, I guess, aware of that. And when we already, start to think of what are we going to say at the Seder, and we begin getting ourselves, along with everything else that it means, to get into Pesach mode. So part of that is preparing for the Haggadah mode. And we always think of questions pertaining to the Manishtana or the four sons, maybe the story of Rabbi Akiva at Bnei Brak. And then, like every single year, right, it's invariably the way it happens, that we get to the middle of the Haggadah and we get to Arami Obiravi, and maybe we sing a little bit by, Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu, and then we get to that part of the Haggadah where we just start to move along. And it seems to go on and more pieces in the Haggadah. Then we get to like the page turning stage. Then we get to the Makos, and we dip in the wine, and then it's Dayenu, and then we're like back and ready to go. But there's always that dead spot in the middle. So what I wanted to do tonight is to really zero in on that part of the Haggadah and try to just give some structure, show some of what is going on, bring some of it to life, and share a few insights. So the first point to look at, I'm going to share the screen in a second. We're going to look at the way the Rambam codifies the mitzvah to tell the story the night of the 15th of Nisan. And I think we're going to be in for a surprise, but it's going to be one that gives us an absolutely essential perspective, what we are supposed to be doing when we get to these pages of Lavan and by Nitzak and all those parts of the Haggadah that we go through. Let's take a look right here. You have the Rambam in the Laws of Chametz Umasa. The seventh chapter is where he tells you, after six chapters of laws of chametz and laws of matzah, so the seventh chapter, the Rambam tells us what it's supposed to look like, the mitzvah, when we tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And we're going to focus on really here is Halacha Dalet. Halacha Gimel, the Rambam tells us that part of telling the story is getting the kids to ask questions. And we'll come back to that. We always have to get people to ask questions. And then we have Halacha Dalet. You have to read this inside. What exactly does the mitzvah of telling the story consist of? Says the Rambam, V'tzarech lahaskil bignus ulsayim b'shavach. We have to begin with the derogatory piece and conclude with praise. Ketzad, maschil umsaper, at first we begin to tell, Shebetchila hayu avosenu bimei terach umilfanav kofrim v'toen acharei ha'havel. At the beginning, we say that our fathers in the days of Terach, right before Avraham, were heretics and erred after foolishness. Our great ancestors worshipped idolatry. That's how we have to begin the story. You take a step back, we know that's true. We know that's in the Haggadah, but it's kind of surprising that the first thing that we have to talk about, the story of the Exodus, is something that happened even before Avraham came along. The Rodfin Achar Avodas Elilim, and we chased after gods. Umsayim. Bidasa Emes, we conclude that we reach the true religion. Shekarvanu Hamakom Lo, Hashem brought us close to Him. V'hevdilanu me'umos v'kervanu liyichudo, and He separated us from the nations, and He brought us close to His oneness. It's the first sentence. Surprising it here, there is nothing at all in that sentence about Egypt or about leaving Egypt. So that's something to think about. We're not going to go into that tonight, but why is it that when the Rambam says we need to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, how do we do that? And the first ingredient, and as we'll see, there are only like two and a half ingredients. The first ingredient has nothing to do with Egypt. Just we began as idolaters, and Hashem brought us close to Him. And that's part one. Then part number two, this is where we're actually going to tell the story. And we have to look carefully and see what that consists of. V'chein, likewise, maschil u'modia, we begin by telling, she'avadim hayinu l'paro b'mitzrayim, we were slaves to Paro in Egypt. V'chol hara'a she'gemalanu, all the evil that he caused to us. Okay. U'misayim b'nisim u'vaneflo she'nasu lanu, and we conclude with all the miracles and wonders that were done for us, u'v'cheirusinu, and we describe our current freedom. That's not a surprise, right? That's the Pesach story. We were enslaved and we're free. But here's the key line. The truth is, I should have only made this red. He says, "Vehu, how do you do this? Sheyidrosh, you should analyze, you should investigate, right? To be doresh really means to investigate. When the Torah says, you question witnesses that come before the court. So we say, vidarashta vechakarta heitev. You're going to investigate, may arame oved avi, ad sheyigmor kol haparsha. You begin to investigate the passage from, quote, until you finish the whole passage. Anyone who adds and extends in investigating and delving into this passage, this is praiseworthy. And then the Rambam concludes in Halacha Hay, and he says, you also have to add, you have to refer to Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. But the question we need to be very, we need to ask, because we just need to be clear that this is true, is the Rambam says the mitzvah of telling the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, there's a text for it. And it's not the Haggadah per se, but it's what the Haggadah really is based around. It is this passage in Sefer Devarim of Arami Obiravi. So what we need to ask is, why are we choosing a passage in Devarim, which we'll look at in a minute, but why are we telling the story by looking at a passage in Devarim? I would have thought we should tell the story by looking at the story, which is what we have in Sefer Shemos. We should every night, we should open every Pesach, we should have the Seder by opening up Sefer Shemos, get everyone around the table, and read the story from when we first went down to Egypt until we come out. Why do we choose three psukim in Sefer Devarim? Now, the Rambam said that was the mitzvah, to read that passage. That's point number one. And point number two is the Rambam says there's a very specific technique for how you are supposed to do this. Remember, the Rambam did not say the mitzvah is likro. It's not to read those psukim. It's not even lisaper. It's not even to tell the story of those psukim. The Rambam said twice, the mitzvah is to be doresh. We have to investigate and analyze those psukim. That is what the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is. It requires investigation and it requires analysis. It's worth thinking about, why is that? Why is that what the mitzvah is? When you're writing, it's better to show than to tell. So let's just take a look. We'll share the other screen. Just to get a sense of what exactly this passage is, Arami Oviravi. And we know it from the Haggadah, but I feel like we never actually get so much of a sense of what Chazal do with the Parsha. Because we just, we know this as the text in the Haggadah. But here, take a look at this. What I have here on the right is the original text in Sefer Devarim. It's the passage in the beginning of Parshas Kisavo when the farmer brings his first produce to the Beis HaMikdash, the Bikurim, and the Torah there says when he brings the fruits and the first grain, so he's supposed to come, he's supposed to make a declaration. And he announces in front of the Kohen, in front of the Mizbeach, the whole story from when we left, from Arami Aviravi until we came into the land of Israel. It's a beautiful passage. You tell the story, you say before Hashem, you're in the Beis HaMikdash, you say, whatever this means, we'll come back to it, Arami Oviravi. You tell the whole story of Jewish history. We became a great nation. We were exiled. We were in Egypt. Hashem brought us out. Hashem brought us to this place. He gave us a great land. And now I bring my Bikurim to Hashem. That's the passage. So Chazal tell us, you take these 3.5 psukim and you are doresh. You investigate. Now, what does that mean in the Haggadah itself? So take a look. We know that it goes on for page after page. But what I did here was I isolated on the left-hand column what the Haggadah is doing and what's the Chumash. And you see, pasuk, you know, example after example, the Torah says, Harami Obidavi, that gets analyzed. One, Vayeirid Mitzrayma, that gets analyzed again. Three, four, five, Bimsema'at, analyzed. Vayisham Legai, analyzed. Gadol Va'atzum, that gets analyzed. Varav, every single word gets analyzed, discussed, dissected in the Haggadah. How many drashos are there in total? You get to the end, 22. I did a word count. It's pretty easy because Microsoft Word did the word count for me. This passage over here, the part that we actually quote from the Chumash, is 44 words. We tell the whole story of Yetzias Mitzrayim in 44 words. When we lane, it takes us a month, right? Parashas Shemos, Va'era, Bo, B'Shalach, to get to the whole thing. We condense it to 44 words. And then after we condense it, we then blow it up and delve into every single word. So we have a sense of what exactly the Haggadah is doing. And that's what Torah Shabbat Peh is about all the time. Rabbi Brand told me this afternoon that he was talking with Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz before Pesach once, who told him that he thinks if someone wants to begin studying Gemara and get exposed to Torah Shabbat Peh, the best way to introduce someone to Gemara is actually not to open Maseches Brachos or Bava Metzia or even a Mishnah. He said the best way to get introduced and get a sense of how Torah Shabbat Peh works is to open the Haggadah. Open the Haggadah. Because this is exactly what Torah Shabbat Peh is. We look at the Torah Shebichsav and we carefully question and think about every single word. Now, why is that the way that we have the mitzvah of Sipur? Why is the mitzvah structured in a way that instead of just telling the story, which is said so nicely, at length, in detail, in Sefer Shemos, why this technique of condensing and then blowing up? So the key advantage is that when the story is condensed in such a like it is right here, it forces you to ask so many questions, doesn't it? It forces engagement. And there are really, I think, the theme of Pesach, the four questions, right? There are four categories of questions that we can ask when we look at the Pesukim here in Harami Obidavi. Because if we're trying to shrink down four parshios into 3.5 psukim, so right away, anything that we're told, we need to ask, why do I need to know this? Right? It's so condensed. Look at what we drop. We drop the makos, seemingly. So why are the parts of the story that are chosen here chosen? It tells us that this is essential. Harami Obidavi. The Haggadah tells us it's referring to Lavan destroying Yaakov. Why is that in Yetzias? Why is that in the Exodus story? Happens back in Sefer Bereishis in Parshas Vayetze. Off the bat, right? This is something that we need to know. I don't know. I didn't know we needed to know it. If I was writing the story, right? We got a homework assignment. Write the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim in 3.5 verses. I would not have put Lavan in there. At length, talking about we came and we were few in number and then we grew. Why does that matter? Why does it matter for knowing the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim that we began as a small nation or as a small group and we exploded in population as a nation? Apparently, that's essential. Had I just read the story in Sefer Shemos, so I would have seen the Pesukim that said, you know, begins Elish Shmos Bnei Israel. We had 12 sons coming down to Egypt, and I would have known that we then multiplied. But I wouldn't have thought that it's an essential part of the story to the degree that it has to be prominently featured in the first pasuk of the 3.5 pasukim talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim. So that's one kind of question that we're forced to ask. This technique of the darashta, you are engaging with the story. Anything that's here, why is it here? Second kind of question we're going to ask is things that do not appear. Apparently, we don't need to know this. Or if we do, why doesn't it appear in the text explicitly? So we look at the pesukim here. Anyone want to jump in? What's one thing from Yetzias Mitzrayim that you might have thought should be here, and it's surprising that it's not?
So it doesn't mention Moshe, but that's the whole Haggadah. It's the whole Haggadah doesn't do that.
Right. So, hey, we never would have had that question, right? That question, why doesn't Moshe appear in the Haggadah? Well, we can only ask that question because Moshe's name is not mentioned in the 3.5 psukim here, right? So that whole world doesn't get off the ground. And that whole treasury of insight that the night of the Seder is all about Hashem, Bechvoda Uvatzmo. It's about the divine presence, God himself intervening, right? We cut Moshe out of the story. Well, we can only cut Moshe out of the story if we cut the story. So that's what we do right here in our Omi Aviravi, is we cut Moshe out, exactly. The Makos do not appear in the 3.5 psukim. So the Haggadah is going to bring them back in. In a few minutes, we'll look at the different views in the Haggadah, how the Makos are brought back in. And it's going to reveal different perspectives about the Makos. But that forces us to ask. 10 Makos. My 3-year-old is coming back from the J, and he knows the Makos song. So, you know, he knows that part of the story. Why isn't that here? We have to ask. If it's not here, we need to know. One piece that Mefarshim point out that's not here, which is really interesting. What was the cause? What was the cause of the exile? Right? Why did we go down to Egypt in the first place? So you read Sefer Bereishis, and if you focus from a perspective of reward and punishment, so you could finish Sefer Bereishis and say the sons of Yaakov are in Egypt. Why? It's punishment for selling Yosef. They sold Yosef as a slave, and now they're going to be slaves in Egypt. Right? It'll be like a perfect midah keneged midah. Well, Yosef does not appear in Arami Oviravi. So is dropping Yosef from the story taking a perspective as to what it's all about? Abarbanel thinks so. So that's question number two. Kind of question that condensing it forces us to ask. The third question we need to ask is, especially in such a condensed format, why do we seem to have so much repetition and insights that we can glean from that? So, you know, we begin the first pasuk tells us already we started as a small nation, but Hisham, there we became Legoy Gadol Atzum Virad. We became a nation, a big nation, a mighty nation, a multiplying nation. Why do I need so many synonyms for the fact that we grew? Are we supposed to extract different pieces from there? The next pasuk tells us the Egyptians, Vayareu Osanu, they did evil to us, Vayanunu, and they tortured us, Benyolenu Avadakasha, and they gave us bitter work. So why those three things? And if we're cutting Moshe out of the story, we're cutting the Makos out of the story, why do I have to describe three different types of evil that Egypt did? Every single pasuk has this, right? There's so much we cut, and that we realize there's so much more that we could have cut, it would seem. We cry out to Hashem, and Hashem heard, Vayishma es kolenu, he heard our voice, Vayar es aninu v'samalinu v'aslachatzenu, he saw our pain and our toil and our pressure. What's the difference between hearing and seeing? What's the difference between pain and toil and pressure? We could have just written the pasuk. We cried out to Hashem, Vayishma es kolenu, right? Lakshon Esrei. We could have ended the pasuk right here. What's all this? Every single pasuk, adding a couple of words, and we need to ask, wait, what's that doing here? can unlock a whole new world. And that's how Chazal have the Haggadah, which is going, right, so much being built and built and built, the insights that we get, we participate in the process. And that's what Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is all about. Getting the little kids to ask the questions by doing funny things at the Seder plate. But then the truth is, they can say, what we do to the kids by doing funny things at the Seder, Hashem basically does to us by giving us these 3.5 psukim and saying, hey, you know, I'll ask you the riddles now. You know, you're taking the Seder plate into the kitchen, out of the kitchen. You have matzah, no chametz. The kids are asking manashtana. Well, you should ask the same questions. Why is this in the pasuk? Why is that in the pasuk? Why is this being repeated so much? And then the fourth kind of question to ask, I think it's like a general Torah Shabbat Pat question, is besides what makes it in, what doesn't make it in, what gets repeated, is why are you using particular words, right? The word choice is the fourth major question that that gets focused on, right? So just an example at the very beginning. Arami Ovid Avi, Vayered Mitzrayma. He descended to Egypt. So Torah could have said he traveled to Egypt, right? We could talk about Nisiya, traveling. We could talk about Halicha, we could talk about walking. Why specifically use the term of descending? Why use the term of Yirida? And that kind of question we can run and ask throughout. So those are the four categories of question that the Haggadah is already doing some of the work, a lot of the work expanding. The Mefarshim are doing the work expanding. And the Rambam tells us that it's our job to do as well. In order to fulfill the mitzvah of Sipur, we need to be Doresh. We can't just open the book and read it out loud to everyone. That's reading. That's not analyzing. We need to take these 3.5 psukim and actually think about it. What's here? What's not here? What's going on? Okay. So, with that like general perspective in mind, so I just want to give a few examples. So I thought the goal of this year was really to help everyone thinking on their own at the Seder night, but I'll just give a few examples and kind of bring this kind of technique to life, because the Haggadah does this. This is why the Haggadah is going on so much. But then the next level question is, where do we come in? So if we take a careful look, we'll see, we can kind of extract some of the insights that Chazal are already extracting. I'll load up the screen share again in a second. But remember, we have at the end of the whole Arami Ovid Avi piece, we talk about the Makos, right? And that's where we dip the wine. And then there's a doubling, right? Because we do Dam, Tzvardeya, Kinim. And then at the end, we have Rabbi Yehuda, who gave them the signs. Yeah, the Tzach, Adash, Be'achab. And so I was like, okay, fine. So Rabbi Yehuda had some other way of counting it. And for some reason, this is important, I guess, as a way of we drink enough wine at the Seder, so we get 3 more drops out of the cup by doing the Tzach. So what is being added in that part of the Haggadah? And I think there's a very clear answer. Let's take a look at what's going on. So here's the piece again. Got to go all the way down to the bottom. And we'll see what was it exactly that Chazal were working with when they had this whole passage at the end. So it was the last pasuk that we read. It was the pasuk where we described how Hashem took us out. I'm just going to scroll up for 1 second. You'll see, right? Hashem took us out. Yatsiyan Hashem Mitzrayim, biyan chazakah, with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, zohar netuya. Great awesomeness, maragadol, osos umofsin. So Hashem took us out with these 5 things. So right away, we have to ask, what exactly do these 5 things mean? What do they mean? Why these 5 and not anything else? So the Haggadah continues. And first, maybe the most important one of the whole Arami Ovid Avi is Drasha number 17. V'yotzeinu Hashem mimitzrayim, and this is where the Haggadah says that Hashem did it by himself. Lo ayli malach, lo ayli sarach, right? Hashem did it by himself. The proof, by the way, that this is the most important part of the whole analysis of Arami Oviravi is this is the only part where the Haggadah now stops darshaning the pasuk in Devarim and begins to then darshan a pasuk in Shemos. Right? You see how there's an extra paragraph here, because the core of the whole story is Hashem himself took us out, right? The Moshe insights from before. So that gets boiled down to right here. Haggadah continues, Dever, Cherev, Gilu, Shechina, Mat. Okay, done. Then we say, Davar, Acher. Another interpretation is you have these five things, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2. And the second view in the Haggadah is that it's these five that refer to the 10 makos. These five represent the 10 plagues. And then we have at the end, Rabbi Yehuda giving us the Tzach Adash Be'achav. So what is going on here? The answer probably is, you know, let's think of it this way. The first view in this part of the Haggadah, right, before we get to the Davar Acher. So it says, what is the difference between the mighty hand and the outstretched arm? So the mighty hand, that's the Dever, and the outstretched arm, that is the sword. That is the sword. So let's ask a question. What sword? What is the sword that is featured in the Pesach story? Any thoughts? I don't think the word cherev appears once in Shemos.
Probably
not. Take a stab.
Maybe Makas Bechoros.
Excellent. Yes. Okay, the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon says Makas Bechoros. Good company. Vilna Gaon says Makas Bechoros. So why is that so important? We're highlighting two of the 10 makos, Dever and Makas Bechoros, number 5 and number 10. So we have three views in the Haggadah. Remember, the makos don't appear in that passage of Arami Aviravi. We have three views at the end where the makos come from. One says, Yad Chazaka Zroa Netuya, the mighty hand and the outstretched arm, refers to Dever and Makas Bechoros. Then we have that second view, that all five of those refer to pairs of makos. And then Rabbi Yehuda says, oh, he gave his simanim de tzach adash be'achav. What you have is three different ways in Chazal of conceptualizing the plagues. I feel like, did I make this a Word document that's open? I hope I do, because it'll be easier if I can show it. Yeah, here it is right here. Document number 12. So just 1 second, and you'll see what's going on. Show all windows. There we go. This is what is being analyzed at the end of the Haggadah. The first view that highlights Dever and Makas Bechoros thinks of the plagues as two groups of five. The second view in the Haggadah that says, no, when the Pasuk said, Yad Chazaka Zroa Netuya Mora Gadol, it was viewing the plagues in pairs, blood, frogs, lice, animals, etc. And then Rabbi Yehuda has a third view that he is looking at the plagues in groups of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That is not how you spell firstborn. As a firstborn, I should know how to spell that, that word. Forgive me, I apologize. So now what you then need to do is part of the process of being Doresh is, okay, well, what does it say about the Makos if I'm looking at them from these three different perspectives, right? How are these three different perspectives arguing about how to conceptualize the plagues? Well, this first view that says that it's we just highlight pestilence and the death of the firstborn. The reason for doing that is if you look at don't take my word for it. Go back at some point before Pesach and look at the Pesachim and Sefer Shemos. We know that Hashem hardens Paro's heart. And that's like the big philosophical question. How could Hashem take away Paro's free will, etc.? Well, the Ramban points out that if you look carefully, Hashem does not harden Paro's heart until after the fifth plague, until after the plague of Dever. And what's even more interesting is that in the middle of all those makos at the end, Hashem says to Moshe, here's the deal. I could have wiped out Paro after Dever. Literally, the Pasuk says this. I'm keeping him around to show him my osos and mofsin. So the Ramban explains that the whole second half of the makos were of a totally different goal than the first half. The first five were there to get Paro to let the Jews go. The second five, that ship has sailed. And now they're just there to show Hashem's unlimited power. Because after five, right, five strikes and you're out. Hashem said, I could have just wiped out all of Egypt after the fifth plague. If you look and think about it, plague one and five line up, six and seven, six, two and seven line up. You can really parallel the plagues in this way. Dam, which is, you know, the blood, the river turned to blood. And then the second cycle, it becomes much more severe. Their own flesh turns into blood. The second plague, you have the frogs, which are creating tremendous noise, but on the ground. And then the hail is creating terrifying sound, but it's coming from the sky. You have lice, which are annoying insects. And you have locusts, which are insects, which are terrifying. And they've never seen tiny before. And it steals all their food and eats. And they're left to starve. The Arov locks the Egyptians inside their houses. And then the Choshech is this supernatural experience that forces them inside their houses. And then you have the Dever versus Makas Bechoros, the death of the animals versus the death of the people. So one way of conceptualizing the Makos, and that's the first view in the Haggadah over here, is that we think in the context of what Hashem did to Paro. Right, the punishment that was brought upon Paro. And that's why it's then connected with the other pieces there according to that view in the Haggadah. The blood and the staff that brought all the punishments, etc. We think of the Makos in terms of punishment. Paro sins, he gets punished, he loses free will because he sinned. He gets punished more. The second view in the Haggadah, right, which was the one that said, we look at the two and the two and the two, Yad Chazak Ashtayim, Zroa Netu Yashtayim, Mora Gadol Shtayim. So, you know, the Makos certainly work in pairs as well, don't they? The blood and the frogs, those were the ones that came out of the river. The lice and the Arov, especially if some of the Mepharshim think the Arov were swarms of gnats, then those go together very well. Dever and Shchin are both forms of illness. Hail and locusts are both destroying the crops. Darkness and the death of the firstborn, Choshech already is the pre-sage of the death of the firstborn. So the second view, what's going on over here, is looking at the Makos from the perspective of the increasing display of Hashem's power. And that's why it gets compared, right? Those five pieces in the Haggadah are of increased intensity. You begin with Yad Chazaka, and then you go to the whole Zroa Netuya, right? You go from the hand to the whole arm, to Mora Gadol, to fear, then to osos, which goes beyond fear to supernatural signs, to mofsim, which are a mofes, is a beyond supernatural, unbelievable event. So the second way of looking at the makos is just coming out of how to take apart Arami Ovid Avi, is to think of the Makos from the perspective of not necessarily punishing Paro, but Hashem displaying his own power. And then Rabbi Yehuda comes in at the end. He says, no, I disagree with both views in Agada so far. I don't think of the Makos in terms of Dever and Makas Bechoros and their teams. I don't think in terms of the pairs of 2, 2, 2, 2, 2. I look at the Makos in terms of Titzach Hadash Be'achav. Mefarshim explain what is going on over here. The first three focus on what is coming out of the ground. The second three focus on what's kind of above the ground, the Hashem's sovereignty over animal life itself. And then the last four are getting into the sky and beyond. In other words, we're focusing on the scope of Hashem's power. Not just the increase in his might, but where Hashem's power applies to. So three different perspectives of the Makos. You would never have gotten this just from reading Sefer Shemos, but you analyze the Psukim, and you analyze that one Pasuk, which the Makos aren't here. Since the Makos are not in the text, I need to doresh them from what's happening in Sefer Devarim. And lo and behold, once you have to be doresh and you're getting into the smallest details, well, there are different ways of doing this. There are different viable perspectives. And we emerge with three views of the Makos that we never had. We just would have known. We would have finished Shemos and we'd know the nursery story that Hashem did these things to Paro. Now you take, oh, wow, I can look at the Makos from the perspective of punishment. I can look at the Makos from the perspective of Hashem's display of awesome might. I can look at the Makos from the display of Hashem's total control over the whole universe. Those are three different perspectives. Someone raised their hand. Yeah.
Thank you. Just, it's so interesting because if to your point about having the Makot be symmetrical and having one parallel to another one, it evokes a little bit the idea that Avraham's Nisyonos were symmetrical and parallel with one another. And if we're saying that so much of the narrative starts with the idea of Mitchila Ote Avodah Zarah and starts with Avram and the Bris Ben HaBesara, and then it's another nice way of aligning the fact that, you know, if number one links to number 10 and number two links to number 9 type thing with the Nisyonot, it also aligns nicely with the Makot.
Interesting. And I actually like that a lot, because what that also helps point out is that we, wanted to move to this next, and we'll close with this. So just a couple of like nuggets in Arami Yobi Navi itself is the fact that the Avos appear here in the first place, right? Remember the question of why do I need to know the history of the Avos? So Danielle is pointing out that even from a certain perspective, what happens in Egypt, right? Parallels 10 trials, 10 plagues, we can think about that. But why do I need to know about what happened to Avram, Yitzhak, or Yaakov when I'm thinking about the story of Sefer Shemos? So, right, we begin with Arami Ovid Avi. That happens to be, what are the words Arami Ovid Avi mean? Literally, what do they mean? Arami Ovid Avi. I know the word Avi means my father, and I know the word Arami means in Aramean. Ovid usually means to destroy or to lose. And we think, oh, my father was a wandering Aramean, which Rashbam says. He says that refers to Avraham. Chazal here say refers to Yaakov being, Lavan trying to destroy him. The fact that we begin with, the whole passage begins with some of the most ambiguous words in all of Chumash, right? Like, just literally, what do the words even say? So that is the perfect invitation, happens to be, to being Doresh, right? You can't take this passage at face value, because you have to begin questioning. And you have to realize that there are multiple ways of reading this text, right? We're going to see multiple ways of conceptualizing the Makos. You can't begin the passage. You can't begin reading it without realizing that there can be multiple levels of meaning. This can refer to Avraham. This can refer to Yaakov. Shadal, the biblical commentator from the 1800s, actually thinks, he says, you know who's the Arami Ovid Avi? Who's the wandering forefather? He says Arami Ovid Avi actually refers to all of the Avos. He says it refers to the joint experience that all the Avos had. All of our fathers, you know, we descended from Aram, and all of our forefathers were wandering. What's the idea going on there? Is to realize that the experience and the exile in Egypt was nothing necessarily new. To some degree, we had done this before, right? You know, talk about the refuah before the Makkah. We go down to Egypt, and this may be what Chazal are driving at, why that is so important, and we are going to endure terrible suffering. But we have to realize we were given the tools to, it's like this is not our first rodeo, right? Before Hashem sent us down to Egypt, he gave us the experience of suffering, and he gave us the demonstration of divine geula after that. And the Haggadah argues even worse. I wouldn't have said that. I would not have said that Yaakov's time with Lavan was worse than our time with Mitzrayim. But Chazal points out from a certain perspective it was, because the entire Jewish people were not going to be annihilated in Egypt, but Lavan chases after Yaakov, and if not for the fact that Hashem shows up in a dream and tells Lavan, you better stand down, right? Haggadah points out he would have wiped out everybody. So before we even begin the story, and one of the huge questions in the story is how could Hashem let this happen to us? Well, we start the story by realizing that in a way, we've been given the tools to know how to handle this from the beginning. So many takes on this, but just like one idea. And then just a couple more, and then we'll end. Just like the kind of questions we can ask on every one of these pieces of Arami Ovid Avi on our own of the Seder. So what comes after the piece with Arami Ovid Avi? So we say, let me just load it up. Scroll back up to the top. So we say, number two, Vayered Mitzrayma. He went down to Egypt, Onus al pi hadibur. So Yaakov went down to Egypt, and he was forced by the divine decree. So stop and think for a second. Any questions about that? So let's rethink our Bereishis history. Was Yaakov forced to go down to Egypt by divine decree? He goes, maybe he goes down to Egypt because he needs food. Maybe he goes down to Egypt to see his own son. Both of those are in the Psukim in Parashas Vayigash. Yaakov says, let me go see my son before I die. So what does it even mean that Yaakov was onus al pi hadibur? And why do we need to know that? Why is it significant for our retelling of the Pesach story to know that Yaakov was forced to go down to Egypt? So just one person who tackles this, Abarbanel, writes about this. The Abarbanel actually says, if you look at the Rambam's Haggadah, it's a really interesting thing to do. In the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam has his Haggadah, and it's really interesting to see what is there, what is not there. Dayenu is not there in the Rambam's Haggadah, I don't think. The one piece of Moshe, yeah, not there in the Rambam's Haggadah. The Abarbanel says, in the Rambam's version of the Haggadah, this does not appear. Vayered Mitzrayma Anos al pi hadibur doesn't show up. So he says, clearly, if it's not there, we need to be asking, you know, what's going on. And the Abarbanel himself says, actually, this is beyond essential. Says, first of all, what does it mean? I'll tell you what it means, he says. It means, yeah, Yaakov wanted to go down to Egypt. But what did Yaakov plan on doing when he went down to Egypt? He wanted to see his son. So the hope was, he'll go down to Egypt, he'll see Yosef, maybe he'll wait for the end of the famine, and he'll go back. He wasn't planning on moving to Egypt. He was hoping to go down, it'll be a visiting day, it might be a long trip, okay, visiting day traffic, so you got to schlep over to Egypt, then they'll come back.
That's what Lagor Bar is fun.
Exactly, right? Then that's the next insight of the Haggadah. Lagor Sham, it was supposed to be temporary. Remember, Hashem then shows up to Yaakov in a dream. Yaakov offers karbanos because he's nervous. And Hashem tells Yaakov, you're going to go down. You will die in Egypt, but Yosef will take care of you. Yosef will close your eyes, Hashem tells Yaakov. And Hashem will, and Yosef will bring you back to be buried in Israel. So the Abarbanel says, what was happening right there? Hashem was telling Yaakov, what you're hoping for, you know, good news, bad news. The good news is Yosef will take care of you and you'll be buried in Israel. Now, the bad news is you're going to die in Egypt because your hope for this to be a little short visit and then have the whole family come back to Israel after visiting Yosef or after the famine is over, that's not going to happen. I am telling you now, you are going down to Egypt and you must stay there. So then Yaakov has that mindset. He doesn't want to be going. He goes then to Egypt. Just imagine, you know, the scene. It's like emotional once you think about it. He then travels knowing he's never coming back to Israel, for sure, because that's what Hashem just told him, right? That hope he had of coming back has just been dashed. But he has no choice. He has to go back. Okay. Why does that matter? Why does that matter for our experience of the story? Well, says Abarbanel, the fact that Hashem made Yaakov go down and promising him he's going to come back up, says, we're not focusing on the Shvatim. We're not focusing on Reuven, Shimon, and Levi going down. He says, we're focusing on Hashem making Yaakov go down. What does that tell us? He says, this supports the view that the exile in Egypt was not about punishment for the sale of Yosef. Says if the punishment for the sale of Yosef was the cause of the exile, then we would not, in our three pasuk summary of Yetzias Mitzrayim, focus on Hashem making Yaakov go down. We would focus on him making the Shvatim go down. So the Barbanel says in that one word, Vayered Mitzrayim, right? That's the word choice the Torah uses. He descended. What does it mean he descended? It means he went down knowing, oh my gosh, I'm going to Egypt for all time. He's being forced. Hashem is saying, you're not going to come back. But we can extract and see from there that the galus was not caused by the sale of Egypt, of Yosef. It was for other reasons. You want to know why? Go look at Abarbanel. So, and then you can continue with, you know, as going through the rest of this part of the Haggadah, asking what these words mean, right? Why? What is the difference between Goy, Gadol, Atzum? What are these different things? Vanitzak, right? We cry out. Well, take a look at the Pasuk. The Pasuk we quote in Sefer Shemos doesn't say we daven, right? It says we daven to Hashem. No, we don't. The Pasuk in Shemos says we just cried out. Why is that there? Why do we focus on Hashem el Elokei Avoseinu, the God of our forefathers? Once we look at this level of detail, right, the technique of drasha, it forces us to ask the questions. And just like that's what we're doing with our kids, that's what we're supposed to do with ourselves. And because that's the whole experience of Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, with this perspective, we'll close. The sole much of the whole, you know, the whole Seder night is to try to not just have another Yantif, but to really try to re-experience, right? And to get our mindset back as if we were leaving Egypt. We can't do that passively. We can't do it passively. That has to be something that's done with active engagement, with stepping forward, putting ourselves in the text, putting ourselves in the story. And the way to do that is by getting the kids to ask, but then getting ourselves to ask. And this technique of being doresh is all about making sure that we are not just, you know, the consumers of Yetzias Mitzrayim, but we're participants because we're involved in learning about it and thinking about it and having our own ideas and our own answers to the questions and our own questions that need to be answered. And that gets then transmitted to the next generation. And maybe one of the kids at that Seder has an idea and they get brought in. And that's the whole mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's remembering the story, but also so much more. And hopefully what we cover tonight is like a few examples of how the Haggadah tries to get us to do that. So, wish everyone Chag Kasher V'Sameach, wherever you're going to be. And thanks, everyone, for coming tonight.